podcast that was Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 48 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? Today I'm speaking to Cam Blackley, who used to be my art director, which reminds me of a story I once heard about the Rolling Stones, where I think Mick Jagger said something about Charlie Watts, blah, 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 my drummer. And Charlie Watts punched him in the face and he said, I'm not your drummer, you're my singer. So the Rolling Stones, they always got on very well, I think. But yeah, I don't know if art directors have copywriters or copywriters have art directors or the other way around. Anyway, so we worked together for a few years at the beginning of like 2001, 2003, something like that kind of time. And we did some good ads. I'm not going to blow smoke up my own ass, but, you know, we got into various D&AD-ish kind of things and whatever. We talk about that a bit later. So that was cool. And then Cam went on a different path, which in all modesty or immodesty became, I guess, a lot more successful than mine. I mean that in award terms, but also he's in a really good position in terms of what he's done as a creative director and ECD, and now becoming CCO of M&C Saatchi in Sydney. So, you know, he's really gone on from strength to strength. He's won a D&AD gold pencil. Not too many people have done that. And I don't know the whole list of awards, but a few silvers as well and some things at Cannes. And it's all gone really, really well for him. So he finally qualified to be a guest on If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas. But yeah, I think for a while, you know, Cam's definitely, his career's been worth a chat. And we met up in LA a few weeks ago. For Cam's, it was Cam's birthday, and we had dinner, and it was really good to see him. So, you know, now's the podcast chat, and so you can hear all about his career, and there's some really interesting stuff in there, particularly if you're coming from a country to another country and see if you can make that work. I think Cam's tenacity and persistence and things like that are a really good lesson to anyone into how to build a career and sustain it at a really high level. So without further ado, here is my chat with Cam. Hi, Cam. Thanks very much. I would say for making the time, but only you and I will find that funny. So I'll just say hi. Thanks a lot for joining me. That sounds like we're in a sort of chat show, but thanks anyway.
You have saved me from a 22-degree day where I'd usually be in the park with my kids are out at the park with my wife and they're handling crocodiles and snakes. So I'm more than thrilled to be sitting in my bedroom drinking beer.
Fantastic. I think we both, I think it's about 20 something degrees in LA today as well. So if anyone's listening who doesn't live in Australia or the west coast of America right now, tough shit, really, is all
it's glorious.
Yeah, it's really good. Sorry. Okay, so
I was hoping we were going to be able to talk about Tottenham pumping Arsenal, because I was all G'd up. I thought it was last night, but it's not for another week.
Yeah, I think if we did do this in a week's time, that would be what we could talk about. So thankfully, we're a week early, and I'll just suffer alone in a week's time and take that on. So yeah, I normally kind of just go through these chronologically because it gives us a path to kind of touching on whatever is most interesting in anyone's career. So like, where did you start, and why did you want to get jabbed at? Obviously, I've met your dad, and he was an advertising, if anyone doesn't know it, Cam's dad is and has been an advertising great in Australia. So was it from him that you got the kind of bug or the inspiration?
No. And someone asked me that actually the other day as well, and that they were really intrigued about that. But I think I wasn't really that aware of I was aware of going into advertising agencies as a young kid and stealing coins from art directors' desks and stuff, but I never really kind of fathomed what they were doing. And then, you know, when I was getting kind of more into mid-teens and all that kind of stuff, like, Dad really was warning me off advertising. He said, don't do it. And I don't know if he thought I wasn't capable of doing it or whether he kind of saw the slippery slope of those 50% margins disappearing and media taking the lines cut as they sort of separated from advertising agencies and blah, blah, blah. But, yeah, I actually got into Monash University for architecture, and having I did some work experience in an architecture firm and decided that was absolutely dull. And then I went and did a year of fine art and just bided my time. Instead of a gap year, I just did fine art, like painting and drawing and stuff, and bided my time and tried again for a graphic design course, and I ended up getting into university to do graphic design. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, my kind of the path in, but the slight twist in the tail there was because I thought I was going to be a graphic designer, but I was inherently lazy. After 1 year of graphic design at this university, the university had a campus in the city and a campus an hour away. They decided to move the graphic design to the campus, which was an hour away, and they were going to change the course that I was on, or the building that I was into, advertising. And so I was just like, oh, bugger it, I'll stay and I'll do advertising.
Interesting path. Yeah. It's funny how I talked to us.
I thought I knew some people in the advertising industry. We'll give it a crack.
Cool. And which agency did you sort of start off in, and or how did the course lead to something a bit more directly into the industry?
Yeah. Well, I was never really into that campusy stuff, and I'd go and, you know, and student unions and stuff, and I'd get the briefs and I'd do them and I'd do them proficiently, and sometimes I'd do them really, really well. But I always found that notion, like those stories you heard about people who, you know, in the UK you do, what's your internship called?
Like when a you placement?
Sorry?
A placement, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Over here, like there was the kind of more romantic notion was getting into the creative department through either being working in the mailroom or working as a TV production assistant, and that was kind of the way in. And I always thought to myself, that was kind of like a cooler way to do it. And instead of finishing uni, I wish I had gone through the mailroom, but I entered a competition in a newspaper, and I won the competition to be a copywriter. And the grand prize was to go and work at Grey Advertising and write catalogues for retail.
Second prize, two jobs at Grey working on catalogues and retail.
Yeah, I guess what that meant to me, and my kind of my convoluted analogy to mail rooms and getting in through kind of more romantic paths was at least I was in. Yeah. It was a foot in the door, and I didn't end up completing university anyway. But while I was working. But it meant that I was able to get involved with briefs and have a look around and sniff around after dark, after people had gone off to their long lunches and never come back, and find other briefs to work on. And that's kind of a little bit of cliche, but I think 22, 23 years ago, that's just the reality, you know, and you found your opportunities because they certainly weren't handed to you on a plate.
And was Grey, like, I mean, Grey's obviously got a better reputation now for what's happened in the last 5 or 10 years in London. But when I started in advertising, it was, you know, it was as grey as its name. And was that the same in Australia?
I don't want to talk it down too much. I think, you know, they did give me my start, and, you know, they had big retail accounts. But they also had the Army, Navy, Air Force over here, which was kind of, at least that was interesting. And it was also the place that was doing the work for the Transport Accident Commission, which was winning Gold Lions every year. It was the commercials where people were killed or arms and legs were ripped off in car accidents, and they had lines like, if you drink and drive, you're a bloody idiot, or built up or suffer the pain. So they were kind of the first people to kind of take a really confronting approach to transport safety and motor vehicle safety, and so they did pick up lines for that. So there was a glimmer of light at the end of the corridor where we could go and talk to Greg about what was going on next and try and write the next TAC commercial, and and obviously he would always find his work more compelling than ours.
And so did you get a chance to do good work there, and how long were you there?
Yeah, listen, we made a few bits and pieces, and I was at Grey for 4 years, and that's my general stints of places are around 4 years, I think. We got to do a few things, you know, with the very first TV ad we made, which I think is a really, it's a really good idea, but executed with no money in a time before, you know, post-production was really firing. But it was for a Remington Dustaway cordless vacuum cleaner, and it was basically an elephant's trunk and a vac and the cordless vac fighting over a peanut. And I just really thought that was a cool ad. So we did that, and it was, you know, I think if we made it nowadays, it would be pretty cool, and it'd still stand up. We did a few TAC things, you know, little bits and bobs, and I won the young creative position on the to go to Cannes as well. So that was kind of cool, and I got a little bit of a taste for what was going on over at the other side of the world. And then the thing was, we were given some responsibility, Jason Williams and I, and Jason Williams is now the CCO of Leo Burnett in Australia. But I think, you know, rather than move to Sydney, it was more about challenging ourselves. And I mean, for me, I've always wanted to find the best people in the world to work for, or the best places, people who are infinitely more talented than myself, and let them kick the shit out of me. So I think London was the absolute choice at the time. I mean, it was head and shoulders above anywhere else in the world for craft, DNAD, and I still romantically love DNAD as well. Like, you know, DNAD was a thing. It was the number one thing for me to want to try and get into with an award. And, you know, even just getting in book back then was really, really special. So we set off with no job and no nothing, with portfolios, and came over to London in, I think it was the end of 1998 or the start of 1999.
All right, so this is you and Jason, is it?
Yeah, me and Jay. So we came over and we had a little bit of an in with Grey, so they were willing to have us at the Grey office in London for a few weeks and for 50 quid a week, which was, you know, very much appreciated as backpackers, Aussie backpackers.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he decided, his missus really wasn't into it, so he decided to head off, so I was left there by myself, and Zorica and I, obviously you know Zorica, my wife,
yeah,
we just decided we're going to tough it out and see how it, you know, see how it pan out.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, I think there's, in those days, Australia wasn't as, like, known as London is. And in the intervening years, I think Australia's become a much more, the reputation, creative reputation of Australia has become much, much stronger. And that's really interesting. But the number of Australians who came over to London, I mean, we knew a few others at AMV. I mean, was that a path that was, like, you know, a kind of rite of passage for a lot of younger Australian creatives, or just Australians in general?
Yeah, I absolutely think so, and I think you wanted to prove yourself with the best. And I think also I don't underestimate the tenacity of Australian creatives, but we just never had the kind of the budgets or the time or the craft or the really the depth of senior talent there to really bring people up. And so I think it was just about going to a proving ground and seeing how it all panned out. So, but anyway,
what do you think?
After 6 weeks at Grey, Tim Mellors called me into his office and said, "We can't afford to pay you 50 quid a week anymore." And my rebuttal to that was, and it was very fortunate, was that, oh, Peter Suter gave me a job yesterday, so I'm going to have it made anyway. So I felt very pleased with myself, to say the least.
Yeah, so, I mean, one thing I was going to ask is, what do you think it gave you the tenacity to go, right, we are going to stick it out at 50 quid a week and not do what Jace did and go home? I mean, do you think there's a thread of that running through how you are and how you approach your job and career?
Yeah, I do. And also, I mean, you touched on the fact that my dad was in the industry. I did, and I've said this in another thing as well. I did spend a lot of my early career trying to run away from dad's legacy.
Yeah.
And so, and I think that's just being like a fucked up young male with kind of too much ego and stuff like that and wanting to do it for yourself. So for me, it was kind of like there was no option. I didn't want to go back to Australia with what I'd perceive my my tail between my legs and begging for a job. And always, like, no one really gives a shit about you when you're that young, but you think to yourself, oh, everyone's going to go, oh, he didn't make it, or he didn't do it, or, you know, he's not as good as his dad. So I really, that really plagued me, and it really just forced me to, you know, it forced us to live in a bed, sit for 18 months, you know, with, you know, cooking next to the bed and not living very pleasantly because it just refused to go home.
Well, that's great. So did you get in contact with Peter? Because the other thing that I find really interesting is that when you, at that point, if you told someone you were going to Abbot Mead, it was a very satisfying experience because I became a junior at AMV around the same, around that kind of time. And there were people I hadn't seen for like 6 months and they'd go, so what are you up to now? And I go, oh, I work at AMV. And they'd be like, you what? And I'd be like, yeah, I work at like the best advertising agency yeah. in the world. It's kind of cool.
Just a little wiggle of the head that says, yeah, I've made it.
Yeah.
I didn't go through Peter. No, I, so Cam Mitchell was working there at the time, and you know Cam,
yeah,
obviously, because we were there together. And he was looking for a partner, and he used to work for my dad at Clemenger's, and they were mates. And Dad said, "Oh, here's Cam's number. He's looking for someone to work with." So I just spent the nights when I was working at when I was filling a seat at Grey, I'd go to Cam's house, or we'd go meet it for lunch or whatever, and just try and put together. He already had a job, but just try and put together some work together so we could show Peter and sort of show that it could be a possibility that could work out. And yeah, so that's how that came about. And then he introduced me to Peter, and obviously Peter knew Dad, so you know, let's not be silly about it. It was going to be a little bit easier path for me than someone straight off the street, but I felt that I had gone through channels which sort of bypassed nepotism in my mind anyway.
Yeah, and so again, experience you probably went through the same as I went through. I mean, walking into AMV as a junior at that time, I mean, for me, it was like, Jesus Christ, look at this place and look at all the pencils on all the shelves and all the great teams and Tom and Walt and John Gorse and Nick Worthington and all those people. How was that experience for you?
Yeah, that was absolutely incredible. And there was, Nick Worthington, Paul Brazier, Stephen Vick, Tony Cox. Like, it was just never-ending. And we were lucky enough to have an office up on that plum floor for a little while until Tom Newitt came in one day and kicked us out because Peter had forgot to tell us that we were being moved to another office. But yeah, that was Tom's big bit of pride for doing that, and that's fine, you know, good on him. But yeah, I mean, that was these are names that obviously that you guys were in awe of as well, but we'd also traveled from the other side of the world and going, holy crap, you know, Guinness Surfer is in pre-production.
Yeah.
You know, who are those guys that don't leave the office 23 hours a day and just play movies at 1,000 decibels? And that was obviously Tom and that was Walt really sitting underneath boxes just watching never-ending amounts of reference film. And yeah, and to tell you the truth, like, it's really, really intimidating. And super intimidating to walk into that and to feel that that perhaps you're not worthy. And that was, I've always had a little sort of sense of that about me. And I think that kind of drives me on to go to try and make sure that I don't let anyone down. But yeah, that's really a humbling experience. And a humbling experience walking into Dave Dyan showing him something and seeing a very disappointed face as well.
Yeah.
Well, taking him in a brief that, oh God, I remember the Economist for Europe brief. I think I can't remember if me and you had it or me and Cam had it, and I think we stuck to the traditional red and white type, and we thought we'd written some very clever lines, and they're a little bit, you know, Sean was always really nice, and Dave was nice, but he's a bit straighter. And then the next day they'd done all that European banknote which was absolutely unbelievable. And, you know, I guess you learn from your mistakes, and you learn from seeing the best, you know, absolutely nail it in the most unexpected ways. And, you know, it's such total craft.
Yeah, it was. I guess it was that sort of mixture of inspiration and intimidation. But yeah. Well, for anyone who doesn't know, up to this point, this is the point where you and I started working together. And I know from my point of view what happened. I can tell you, in case it was never clear to you, I'm sure it was. My art director and I, my previous art director and I, Paul, I don't know if Paul's ever going to be listening to this. Maybe he is. We found it very easy to be fucking lazy. Really, really lazy. So we'd occasionally we'd let ourselves get into a sort of lazy state, because AMV was quite self-motivating. It was like, here's a brief, you know, do your best and all this kind of stuff. And if you didn't do it, then there wasn't really a huge kick up the ass there, because it was such a mature agency. But now and again, Paul and I would fall a little bit too far, and Peter would either give us a brief and a kick up the ass, or, and I think at this stage he was like, look, This is not going to work. You guys, you basically need new partners, and either you can make it work with Cam and Cam, because we each got a Cam, or not at all was what it was from our point of view. It was like a last chance thing for being fucking lazy. And so, and I don't mean that as like a wooden spoon situation, but it was like, I think Peter just needed to like go, right, I don't know what to do with you. I don't want to sack you right now or whatever.
Yeah.
Let's see if this could work, I think was what he was doing. And actually, it's interesting that you talked about being in any way lazy earlier on, because I would say 100% what I got enormously out of working with you was the benefit of not being lazy. Like, the amount of work you did really kicked me up the ass really well, and ended up with us, you know, getting those ads in the book and doing some big things like Pepsi. So I really, you know, thank you for that. I'm really grateful for how that changed the way I work. But how was it from your point of view?
Well, I never had a problem with changing partners, and it was, for me, it was always a learning experience. And just to touch on that, the volumes of work, I think, again, I would just put that down to fear of failure. But, and I don't know, we did do a lot of work and we worked really, really hard, but I nowadays, like with my people, don't believe that you have to have the volumes or the evidence of industry to have great work. But I just think that I was in such a state of, God, I can't let anyone down. It's just going to be volumes and reams and just crack through and just see how much we could do. But I think that was, changing partners is really good for me. I think, you know, it was a little bit, it's always like, oh, you've got to feel out someone new, and that's not necessarily feel up someone new, but feel out someone new, and your ways of working. And I think we're very, very different. But yeah, you know, it paid dividends, and I don't know if it paid as much dividends for Cam and Paul, so sucked in.
Yeah, well, and then Cam ended up with Rob, and then Paul ended up with Antonio. And,
well, that did actually. He did go up, and yeah, he worked with Rob. Those guys were really, really good together.
Yeah, but yeah, I think that just as one specific example, because I'll find it and put it on the blog at some point. But I think with Pepsi, I just sort of we did a few things, and I would sort of just give up on it, and then you never gave up on it, and you would go, let's do some more Pepsi. And I was like, oh, fucking hell, this agency has never made a Pepsi yet. We're not going to make it. That was what I was thinking, but oh, fuck it. But then,
we're going to make a Pepsi yet. I was thinking we've got almost £3 million to play with here. We cannot stop working at this. But was that a global brief as well? Was that one of those ones where they farm it out to all the BBDO offices, but New York generally just got to go and make them?
Yeah, I think that was the general thought. And
yeah.
So, you know, and I think us doing it was like a real feather in the cap for all sorts of reasons and people. And you know, doing that shoot with Danny Kleinman and going off to BBDO New York to hang out with them for a bit and all this kind of stuff. So there were so many benefits from doing it. So I was like, wow, if Cam had never like really pushed that, we'd never have got to where we got to in making that ad. So the benefits of persistence, I think, are really huge.
Yeah, that was, I mean, there's, it was a remarkable moment because you're thinking about Danny Kleiman at the time, and he was doing the Xbox stuff and he was absolutely killing it. And I guess we'd always been doing sort of, you know, some of the more minor stuff around and working with good directors, but with, I mean, that was top echelon. So that was incredible. And doing that edit process, I mean, we edited that bloody thing for 18 months, so, didn't we? It was 12, I mean, Phil yeah. Dusenbury, I couldn't work out in the end, in the edit, what he wanted, because we cut that thing 40 million ways. But anyway, I think it got on air somewhere in the world, so we're going to be pleased about that.
Yeah, I've no, I don't think it ever went in England, so I don't think I saw it on air. But yeah, that was a long and interesting kind of process. And so from there, you went to Publicis, which was, I guess, your first contact with Dave Droger. Is that right?
Yeah, so, but what's happening here is we can't gloss over the fact that I got made redundant.
Oh, okay, but let's do that. I was kind of glossing over it, to be honest.
Because I think it's critical. There's a couple of defining moments in my career, and I was always really, really embarrassed about that. God, that was heartbreaking. But I look back and I go, and Peter said, I think, you know, blah, blah, make you redundant. The words to this effect, you go, London's not really working out for you, go back to Australia. And I kind of went, and that was a bit upsetting. And then, you know, in the, first of all, you start with shock and then sadness and then anger. And I was kind of like, what? No, that's fucking bullshit. And what it did was, it made me kind of reappraise where I was at, because whilst you say that I worked really, really hard, I think I got really bogged down in details. Like, I did those Snickers posters, and I think I'd sit in a retouching studio 15 hours a day just moving tiny bits of type around, and like the most minute change to them, and I think this is what I got really into craft, was like I'd go like, oh my God, we've moved this on like 50%, and I got really, really bogged down. So I wasn't necessarily doing myself much benefit, and I could probably see now running companies and stuff like that, I was just burning man hours, which wasn't very efficient. So what that did was it made me go, okay, again, I'm not going to go home. Who next do I seek out? And it wasn't, Droger was doing really, really at Saatchi's, right? He was killing it there. I was looking more for another English person to work with, and you know, and Droger took over Publicist in New York, and if I had really wanted to go work for him immediately, it would have been, oh, let's go to New York. But it was more Nick Sadinsky and Gav Kellett.
Yeah.
And Nick, obviously, you know, another, you know, marvellous art director and talented oddball. And I just stalked him for 3 months, I think, and it was just trying to work that out and trying to find a position in there, and then that did come together. So it was a devastating moment in time, because I haven't made Vickers, and you know, I thought I was going to be there forever, but I really did need that change and that move on, that step up, and that reinvigoration, and working with you know, someone new. We forgot to mention working with Paul and Nigel, which I actually...
Oh, God, yeah.
They were incredible. Like Paul Belford and Nigel Roberts are my all-time faves. I absolutely love their guts. And they were very kind to us. And, you know, in fact, they came into Abbott Mead with that reputation of grim and grimmer, but I never saw it. I just saw people who were just... They were so dedicated to the work and the craft and the, you know... And I think they just didn't suffer fools necessarily, but they did like people who tried hard, and they would implant knowledge on you, and they'd keep your motivation up, and you know, and you're really proud when they, you know, let a piece of work through, so, or when they actually gave you the thumbs up on a piece of work in the form of like yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, that was like winning an award when Paul or Nigel like approved a line or whatever. And I absolutely agree with you. And it was, I never got that grim and grimmer thing personally at all, because I think it depends on kind of what wavelength you were talking to them on. And and how dedicated you were. And I think what you and I wanted to do was, there was a little bit of a, some of the relatively younger teams would sort of hook into the older teams in a kind of mentorish way and go, right, we want to follow you and we want you to give us all the advice and we want to, like, you know, be your guys and learn from you. And I think you and I very consciously chose to do that with Nigel and Paul because they were so fucking good. And I think,
well, I think the style of work, like, you go, like, Nigel's and Paul wrote headlines as well. I mean, but those, I'll say Nigel's headlines because he's down as a copywriter, oh, absolutely brilliant. And those, you know, that style of double-barreled posing the question and then answering it in a really lateral way, and then coupled with Paul's design, which you can't replicate, and I've tried and I've tried and I've tried, and it seems so simple, but it's so, there's so much depth to it and so much meaning to it. Like, I think about that egg stuff, and it was all based on printing on a battery eggs or battery cage, but it was all printed on
the receipt,
cardboard. Oh, and they printed receipts, and they just did so much. He just did so much really incredible stuff, and on the outside that looked so easy, but absolutely not.
I remember at the time, actually, because they were at Ogilvy before they came to AMV, and I remember thinking at the time, God, I would go to Ogilvy. I would leave AMV and go to Ogilvy to work under them because they're so fucking good. And my God, I must be born under a really good sign, because then they just came over to AMV instead, which made life a lot easier.
And they'd done that stuff for Nissan as well.
Oh, yeah, the Nissan stuff. Oh, great.
Yeah, absolutely stunning. Yeah. Anyway, there you go.
Well, yeah. I think
so. Where were we? So, yeah, publicists. And I started at publicists. I can't give you the exact date. It doesn't really matter. I was there for about 18 months in all, or 2 years perhaps. But within 2 weeks of starting there, Dave Droger rang up Nick and he said, oh, I want Cam and the guys working with Andrew at the time to come to Mexico. We've got a pitch to win Coca-Cola for that region. And so we went down there and that was the first experience of actually, that's the first time I ever spoke to Dave, really, and our first experience of working with him, you know, hugely charismatic dude, and we worked our butts off, and I believe we won that one in the end, and so we went back to, I don't think Nick was particularly pleased that we kept on getting dragged out of the office, but about 6 months later, Droger rang me up and said, oh, do you want to come across to San Francisco to work on, it was a Sprint Nextel retention. And I can't remember the name of the agency at the time over there. It was someone who publicists owned, but it wasn't publicist, but maybe it was
Hal Reiney.
I was going to say that. So we turned up there and those dudes were pretty chilled out. When they were about to lose the biggest client, they were sitting around playing guitars and leaving at 4 p.m. and all that kind of stuff. But quite California. But, yeah, we went there and we smashed that one as well, and we had a really good time. So, so that was the kind of the two major Droger experiences. And we did get to make a couple of nice bits of work. We made some good McCoy's ads while we were there. And we had a lot of bad luck on Renault. I think we wrote some beautiful ads for Renault, but they'd keep falling down because the office in France would want to make their work, and, you know, and a similar experience to Pepsi. You know, we'd go doggedly at it, but we just didn't manage to get any of those really big Renault pieces up. We did make something kind of fun for Modus. But then when Droger went to startup in New York, yeah, that's when I got the call, and I knew Duncan vaguely because he was seeing a friend of ours, and she was living in New York with him, and I wrote him a letter about my experiences of sitting on sofas talking with Kylie Minogue and all this kind of stuff, and it seemed to tickle his fancy, so he got me to over there for a proper chat, and so we negotiated. I think we haggled over $10,000 difference in paycheck, and then I had to build all the IKEA shelving in the Broadway office, and you know, and I was working at Droger inside 4 or 5 weeks. And I think I was about the, I always say number 12, but I reckon I was the either between 10 and 12th employee in that office. So they'd just made Air Force One, and they'd, you know, they'd kind of reinvented, they kind of really kind of invented content proper, I'd say, you know, and that sort of guerrilla advertising that didn't require any media budget and all that kind of stuff. And there was a real buzz going on, and they got me in to work. I worked with Duncan, and we had to write shows for Honeyshed, and that was absolutely unbelievable. I loved it, writing TV synopsis and TV shows for a channel that hadn't started yet, and it was just a breath of fresh air from writing TV ads. And, you know, you can take your knowledge on marketing and trying to sell and trying to tickle people and you know, put it into longer form or more interesting episodic form.
Yeah, and obviously in the Hugh Todd episode, I spoke to him about what Dave was like at Saatchi's in London during that time, and that was quite an interesting kind of eye-opener. But could you tell us a bit about what Droga5 was like in terms of, because there were a lot of, I mean, here we can start to talk to someone who's won a gold pencil, and I'm interested in how that came about as an initiative, and did these things just appear on your desk and Dave would go, well, we've got this thing and then this and this and this. What was it actually like on a day-to-day basis there?
You would have spoken to Dave.
Well, weirdly, I had a conversation with Dave about a month ago for reasons I can't quite go into at the moment. But
he's got the most calming sort of presence about him, and I was laughing when I listened to Hugh's podcast because I think he's given up ciggies now, but that whole sucking in a cigarette and going, what else have you got? What else have you got? It's very much in his nature, and it's not done in a way which is, it doesn't say what you've got is shit. It's not nothing to do with that. It's just he's searching for the stuff that you think that that he thinks that you might have edited out that he might see brilliance in. That would be my kind of deduction in that. But it was a very casual kind of way of working. I liked it. I mean, I was really close to Duncan, and obviously we just spent all our time laughing. That's all I remember, just in us in fits of tears. Probably could have been more productive. But, I think I would just have to say that Dave sort of makes everyone feel like it's a place of safety. You're safe to come up with the best and greatest idea you can have, or the most outlandish, and you can present it. And I won't say that we always did that, but we did present some work. Matty, Dave and I presented a campaign to Dave for Mike's Hard Lemonade called My Gay Hand, and he didn't really he didn't mind that. He thought it was quite funny. I'm not sure. I was actually talking to someone about that the other day, and I reckon we worked it up for a pitch, but it never got presented. That would be my deduction. I think he probably, being astute as he is, probably just sort of tucked that to the back of the folio and not wanted to hurt our feelings. But we were able to present, you know, pretty brave and interesting stuff, and in the same way that he was saying, like, he would take something and he would just sell it. You know, he'd be able to sell something just off the potential of the idea. And I think I know he said in other interviews and stuff that potential is his favourite word, and hopefully I've got that right, or hopefully it still is his favourite word. But I think that's all that he really looks for in something. It doesn't have to be completely nutted out. He can just go, the potential of that to be great, you know, and with the people that he has around him, you know, he can sell the thought, and then we can get into the crafting of it later on.
Okay, so specifically, how did Millions happen, and what was that like as a process?
Well, Million was a brief, which was it was a pitch, $16 million to, I think the campaign that they were doing at the time, it was probably a hybrid of a stay in school kind of poster campaign, and I believe that's what they wanted really. That they just wanted, like, you know, like any of these kind of government bodies, I think because that's all they know is that, well, we've done a TV campaign or we've done a poster campaign before and we've got a, you know, a star involved. So we've just got to do that thing again. And it was, I can't remember if it was, I think it was Duncan. Might have been Dave, but I think it was Duncan. But I think that we had identified through planning that the phone was one of the barriers to learning, and I think that's where the idea came from. And I think it was Duncan and Duncan and Ben who kind of said, "Oh, well, why don't we turn it into a learning device, or why don't we turn it into a device which you can get rewarded for learning and et cetera." And that's where it exploded from there. And we put all the bits around it. You know, I still think that project is absolutely incredible. And governments around the world seem really, really keen on it. But and a few, I think we're going to roll it out. I know it did absolute wonders in New York, but it's one of those moments in time where it was good to be in the room rather than be the person who said the actual thought.
Yeah. So, and you mentioned earlier that like you were kind of one of those people who bow before DNAD, and like that was what really obsessed you. So what was it like then getting a gold pencil?
Because we'd always fished around stuff, and we'd never really got the really big ones. And I think what happened was I gave up on any sense that I was ever going to get like a yellow, let alone a black. And I gave up on gold lines. And I think I just got down to making work that we, rather than chasing kind of ideas that we'd seen and trying to or styles, I think we just got down to making or I just got down to trying to make work that I thought would work, you know. And then so when the thing picked up like a gold pencil, and it picked up I'm pacing my room now, and it picked up what did it get, titanium, and it picked up stuff at the top of the one show, and it picked up everything. I was just dumbfounded, but I was also really super chuffed because, like, you go, holy shit, I've got this pencil. But also because it was for the right reasons. It wasn't like we'd made something that was focused on winning those things. It was kind of just like the cherry on top, like it had been recognized, but it was an absolutely super effective bit of work. So, you know, that's why I loved it. I thought that was incredible. And then from then on, I think things really wrapped up when I understood the kind of the potential of absolutely doing the right thing and staying true to authenticity in your work.
Yeah, and that wasn't the only the great Schlepp happened around that time. Was that Droga 5 as well?
Droga 5, yeah, but I'd just left by then.
Okay.
Unfortunately, my mum fell terribly ill So I had to come back to Australia, but it just so happened they were opening up Droga 5 in Australia at the time. So I was, I was able to, be one of the first people in the office over here, which was really, really good. And we worked out of a house. But, yeah, that was kind of the start of a real golden period in New York for Droga 5 there. They did the Great Schlepp, and Tap Project happened while I was there. But that was Dave in an interview. And I think off the cuff someone just said, "Oh, what would you do to sell tap water to people?" And he just came up with Tap Project on the spot. So that's kind of the brilliance of the guy. The rest is history for Droga 5 New York. But it was the start of some pretty good times in Sydney, I think, as well, you know. Because we arrived there. We arrived there with a confidence of the New York office and thinking we were going to remake the great camaraderie and all that kind of stuff that we had going on in New York. But you know that like different offices have different vibes and there's different leaders and different challenges, but we managed to nail a really big client in Victoria Bitter or VB, and do a piece of work that won 2 yellow pencils, and it won a yellow pencil for copywriting, which I was really, really pleased about as well. So it wasn't like that we went there and sort of became the poor cousin little outpost. You know, we were absolutely doing some nice work there as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because you were one of the first employees at Droga 5 in New York, and obviously one of the first in Sydney, if not the first, or whatever. So was the sort of startup vibe something that kind of invigorated you as well, in terms of, if you said you're working out of a house or something, was so rather than being in the full-on machine that AMV was, and it was, you sort of slot into it somehow, was the ability to create your environment somehow something that really appealed to you?
Well, I think what I really liked about it, because I'd gone through a Gray machine and then Abbott Mead, obviously very creative, but a big machine as well, and then Publicis is obviously a big machine. It was more the camaraderie, and it was more the fluid ways of working as well. Like at Droga, we weren't working in teams necessarily. Like, I was working with Duncan, but then I'd work with Dave and Maddie, or then, you know, or they'd plug in a content dude, and you'd work in really kind of interesting ways, and I really thought that, and I said to myself, bloody hell, I never want to go work in a big agency again. And well, that's come back to bite me on the bum, and we'll learn about that later. But I think what I was really learning was like more progressive ways of putting teams together and working for a cause. And I think you've got to understand that when we started, or when I got to the startup Droga 5 in New York, and then when we started Sydney, like it can all go pear-shaped really, really quickly if you don't start firing, if you don't start landing clients, and you don't start kicking a few goals. So I think, again, fear of failure, fear of defeat really drives you even harder, and you really work for one another. You don't work against the team in the office next door, and you don't feel jealous of the team in the office next door. You want everyone to succeed, because just about everyone has their name on the work anyway.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. So, I think it's also interesting in terms of you saying that you earlier on that you'd given up possibly on the possibility of yellow pencils or gold lines or whatever, and then you won a bunch. I mean, I think it's interesting because if anyone's listening to this and they're going, well, maybe I've done 5 or 10 years and I haven't quite hit that height. But for you, your best years came when you'd been in a while. And I always sort of kind of wonder if, you know, people are fully formed, brilliantly talented, and that's it. Or maybe it's either you've got to find the right environment, or maybe something clicks in your psyche where you go, hang on, I should be doing these for effectiveness, not for award kind of things. And those sort of things happen. I mean, I think your path in terms of how that's happened is probably a little bit unusual, I'd say.
Yeah, I guess I've just been a little bit of a sponge, and I do pride myself a little bit on the patience of the career path, but probably a little bit of the tenacity around the work. I wonder how I would have gone if I had a, because I've seen so many people kind of land a lion. It doesn't matter, really matter what colour, in their first year or their second year,
yeah.
Or they get a few recognitions, and then it doesn't quite kick on for them, and they find that hard to work out why. But for me, it's just been like a natural evolution, and I've learned a lot along the way. And I think the further I've gone, you know, the further time's gone on, like obviously you've just said that, but things are getting better and it's been more successful. But I think it's just been due to me soaking up the experience and kind of learning my own voice rather than trying to sort of mimic or replicate or trying to please a lot of the time, trying to please other people with the work. So, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, and I think around that time, didn't you win another pencil for like art direction or something for some TV ads as well?
We did a content series and it did end up on TV as well. We worked with MTV and we made a thing called Boost Mooring.
Oh yeah,
yeah. We got a pencil for that, and yeah, that was fun, man. That was writing long form. We made a a 10-minute documentary, well, mockumentary, and we got to fly around the world and make that, and we got to work with some pretty cool people and work much more nimbly, you know, so rather than going for those big productions, like smaller crews and just, like, great talent and just sort of, you know, meeting the people and then writing stuff overnight and then shooting the next day and then rewriting and then shooting more stuff. And, you know, that was kind of cool. That was a very different way of working. But for the mooring thing, for that art direction stuff, we started to get into sculpture because we wanted this, the kind of the story of this guy who liked to create things that had multiple things on them, and whether he wore multiple hats or multiple jackets, and it sounds pretty shit the way I'm describing it, but it's all right. But we started getting to sculpture, so me and the director, we sat down, and he was from the Glue Society at the time. We started to think about different art projects that this character could do, and then we came up with things like the Gnotum poles, which were gnomes that were molded on gnome after garden gnomes that were molded on top of each other and turned into totem poles, and we created an exhibition with those, and we covered a street sweeper with light bulbs so it looked like a disco ball, and we made a basketball ring with multiple backboards and hoops, and that was like a basketball tree thing, and so that was really cool too, and that was just experimenting with, you know, that was using advertising to kind of make art that, you know, because we don't have a lot of time in our lives, so we're kind of just using our time to do little art projects, but, you know, with someone else's budget, and that was cool.
Yeah, and so at this point, were you getting more responsibility and were you looking for more responsibility to make another kind of step up in your career?
Yeah, I was a CD at, I got the CD level at Droga in Sydney, and, and I was working on, you know, as I said, Cadbury Boost Bar. I was working on Cadbury's stuff and I'd eked out a little niche, and like a selfish creative director sitting in the corner and not really giving a shit about the agency. I did give a shit about the agency, but I didn't care about other creative directors' work. I was really, really just into the stuff that I was doing with my teams. And then the opportunity for ECD came up at BMF, and it took a bit of convincing because it was quite comfy at Droga, but again, it was like, well, you've got to do it at some stage and you've got to take the responsibility and you've got to see if you can take some of the lessons that you've learnt along the way and reshape and remould and see if you can't make an even better place. So, I took BMF and one of the main reasons I did that was it was one of the agencies in Australia. It was independent and it had always had creative work in its blood. It had famously done an ad for Tui's Extra Dry, where a tongue leaves a guy's mouth and goes in search of a beer in the night, and that was kind of famous. But it just had this pedigree, and it was just in a little bit of a slump. But I always knew that an agency that had a creative pedigree to it was very, very capable of being that of having that reawakened within it. So, so that was the clincher. And also, again, it wasn't moving into a big agency. It was a creative department of, I think, 24 or something along those lines. So I got sold the dream and turned up on day one and was told that three of our brands were up for pitch, and so it was trial by fire.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say that you definitely passed that trial. And I think the work that's come out of BMF under your stewardship has been really good. And so do you think, like, you know, the time was just right for you to take that on? And do you do things in a certain way as an ECD that creates that success? Is there a way you go about your job that brings that about out of people?
Yeah, I mean, obviously when you walk into a new place and you've got no allies in there, like, that is it's a learning process, and Australians can be cynical to some degree, and you've got to win people over. But I think what really worked for us was, or one of the things that I did was, and it sounds a little bit soppy, but I worked with the other leaders. There was a moment in time where we had to let go of about 50 people. And it was, and I'd never had to do anything like that because I'd been a creative director sitting in the corner working on my stuff with my teams. And I'd only been in successful places. And I found that, again, that was probably one of those second or third enlightening moments. It was kind of like, I never want to, that's very hurtful to have to let people go and good people. And so we just refocused the business around, we focused it on people rather than the work because we knew that the people were good and the work would come. So I did things like I built financial buffers in that meant that we wouldn't have to let people go if we lost a bit of business or if a bit of business decided to downsize or as they do farm their digital out or stuff like that. So it meant that people could work in a place of safety again. And I've said a place of safety before in regard to Droga, but I'm trying to create an environment that has as few barriers to you being successful in it as I can possibly create in a work environment, because heaven only knows what's going on, you know, in your life outside of the office. So, and the other thing I do is I ask people, like, you know, when I'm shown a bit of work, one of the questions is, do you really want to make that? And I think it seems like a simple thing, but like if you consider the amount of time and effort that we put into stuff, it gets them to kind of decide whether or not they want to invest the amount of time and effort into the script they've just shown me. And you know, 9 times out of 10, I'm saying it because I think that they can do better, but they can come to their own conclusions on that. So I think that that's been useful. The other thing that I've done is we don't pitch for things that aren't a cultural fit for the agency. So we won't, and we've even won brands, but through the process found that we didn't like the not that we didn't like the client, but we just felt that they would be a hindrance to the culture of our place. Like they might upset people in certain ways, or they might create unbalanced working environments. So we've had to send the MD down to say thanks for awarding us the business, but we're not going to take it on. And in pitches, we only present work that we really, really want to make and believe in. We haven't ever presented work that we just say that'll win a pitch. So I think what that does is, I mean, we're a tight-knit bunch, not just for the creatives, but it sort of instills some sense of pride in the output and the culture and what you're trying to achieve as a business. It kind of sets a tone and a direction. And we've even, you know, we've got a pitch going on at the moment, and they wouldn't budge on the date. And so we sent a note to them that said, if you don't change the date, we're just going to have to pull out of the pitch. And so they decided to change the date. So I think trying to operate our business, which is on our terms and protects our culture and our people, I think is really, really, really important. And so that's what I've done.
That's cool. I think, from what I've heard of your time there, you've sort of inspired quite a lot of loyalty from your department. Would you say that? I mean, I don't want you to blow smoke up your own ass if you don't want to.
But... I think we have people come, but people do come and go. I'm very open with people, and I want everyone to go overseas as well, and I think they need to have that working experience. So I just like people to be honest with me. If you plan to go and try your luck in New York in 18 months, well, then let's work towards how we can make that happen. And what that means is that I can drop another when that shark tooth drops out, I can drop another shark tooth in without it being too disruptive. Also, because of the way I like to hire, I also like to make sure that from a personality point of view, and not just talent, but a personality point of view and a skill set point of view, the person will have to be able to easily slot in because I don't really want to have to let someone go after 2 or 3 months because they're, you know, they're really, really good, but they're a bit of a shit. I think loyalty is more that I'm really, really loyal to them and their aspirations and what they want to achieve, and I'm understanding of their personal needs and if they need time, you know, time in the office or time out, and then that two-way street just naturally happens.
Cool. So I guess now's the time to talk about your current move. I don't know if you've started at MNC or not, but do you want to talk about how that happened?
No, we have very long workout clauses in our contracts.
Oh, right.
So I'm still in the trenches at BMF, and you know, and I absolutely love that agency. And ECD is the top position for a creative there, and there's three of us who run the agency. There's only an MD, an ECD, and an EPD, and then there's a holding company. So we really are the day-to-day managers, and it's the best ECD job in Australia because it's a great co-department. We've got great clients. But again, it was one of those things where this M&C job came along, and it's massive. You know, it's massive within Australia, shall I say, in that, like, it's across a few offices. It's got, you know, I do get some global contact as well. And I get to try and, again, you know, they've got a lot of good people there, and they've got a lot of capabilities, and it's a chance for me to sort of go and take, again, the lessons I've learned and try and do them again at scale, like in a really big place with a reputation for being probably more of a machine, I'd say, because, like, you know, any of these big agencies, you know, they have their creative elements, but they've got a lot of people and they have to operate in a certain way. So it'll be about sort of marrying some of their slickness with a little bit of my softy bogan touch, I guess.
But I'm assuming that they've got something in mind for why they've offered you the job. So it's not as if they've gone, oh, well, you know, there's a guy making things happen at a boutique place. Let's, you know, do some of that. So they obviously think that you're a fit for the place.
And I listen, and that was always my thing. And talking to them started a long time ago, and then it was a non-goer. And then for some reason it rekindled, and we kind of, I think they re-looked at the job spec a bit, which I thought was sensible if they wanted me to do it. And then my questions really were, you know, what you touched on there. It was really like, you know, I really feel like I'm very different from you. I see you're a big, successful agency, of course. You're very slick. I don't see myself as slick. And they kind of just feel that the time is right to introduce, you know, a little bit of that into their DNA and their genetic makeup, and I reckon that's for the best. I think it'll be awesome, and you know, I'm really keen to play with all the toys they've got there and see how we can make that work. But you know, see if we can, you know, also make the place really people focused and see if we can get the best out of people in a slightly different approach.
Yeah, I thought it was really. I mean, I'm assuming you've seen the piece about your move in Campaign Brief Asia. I'm assuming it is. I can't remember exactly which one it is, but I think that's the only regional whatever it is advertising newspaper I'm aware of. What interested me about that was the comments underneath, which were universally. I mean, I can't really recall one that wasn't. Cam's a really fucking good bloke. This is a really good move for M&C. Good on you, that kind of thing. Because in the backbiting world of advertising, generally the comments section of pieces of news of that thing are kind of shot through with jealousy and bad blood and things like that. And it seemed to be really, really positive. And I was like, wow, this is really interesting. So
especially on that particular media channel as well. Listen, I ignored it for a few days, and then someone sent me a note going, "Oh my god, the comments on Campaign Brief are awful," or something. And I'm like, "What?" And she's like, "Yeah, don't worry, don't believe what they're saying," and everything like that. And I turned to someone in the office going, are the comments on Campaign Brief, are they awful? And they said, no, to the contrary. And I did read a few, and they were really, really, they were really supportive. And I think everyone can see kind of the value of, and I'm trying not to get arrogant here, but see the value of me going in and working with M&C on some of the most important clients in this market, and seeing how we can, take a little bit of a progressive approach. They're already sort of heading towards some more progressive ways of thinking. But maybe I can, maybe from my point of view, I can get that happening a little bit quicker for them. So anyway. I don't want to give too much away on that stuff, but it's super, super exciting. All I need to do is wrap up at BMF, leave on really good terms because they're my great buddies. I need to have a little bit of a break and then tackle this one and see where it leads.
Cool. So I mean, often when I've got to this stage, I'm like, oh, that brings us up to today. And actually, I think we've brought ourselves up to whatever it is, a few months or weeks into the future, which is great. But I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to say or add or put out there for it.
It's funny because I was looking at I'm just going to open my computer, but I was listening to a Tim Minchin speech. I didn't really want to do a quote because that's a little bit cliche, but it kind of played to. It kind of played to some of the stuff we've spoken about, and it also sort of, it sounds a little bit like the way that I've gone about stuff in my career. Like, I guess, and this is what I think is, I've never really had a plan, I've never really had a plan. I was just following people. I was trying to work for really good people, so we got to work for. Dave Dye, Sean Doyle, Paul Belford, Nigel Roberts, Nick Worthington, Paul Brazier, Nick Sadinski, Gav Kellett. The list goes on. Dave Droger, Duncan Marshall, and just see where that leads. And I really haven't been one of those people who's set Robbins, the motivational
Tony Robbins, speech, yeah.
A speaker goes, by 25 I need to be here, and by 30 I want this, and by 35 I need to have a Porsche in the garage. I drive a shitty Fiat, so I've never had that kind of pathway. But Tim said this, and it really, I really believe this, and I think this is fantastic. He said, be careful of long-term dreams. I advocate passionate dedication to the pursuit of short-term goals. Be micro-ambitious, and I love that, that micro-ambition, that's so cool. It was put your head down and do work with pride with whatever is right in front of you. Just be aware that the next worthy pursuit will probably appear in your periphery, which is why you should be careful of long-term dreams. If you focus too far in front of you, you won't see the shiny thing out of the corner of your eye. And I think when I think about publicists leading to Droger, I was dedicated to publicists, but Droger was the shiny thing out of the corner of my eye. And then I was really loving working at Droger, and then BMF popped up, and I went, okay, I should do that. And I think that's the same thing with M&C. So it's not been a pre-plan. It's just been focusing really hard on trying to do the best I can at the moment. And then when something arises, it just feels like a natural fit. So anyway, that's what I want to leave you with.
That's a good note to end on. That's really good. if your work's all together, I'm always a bit embarrassed here because Dave Dye always digs incredibly deeply into everyone he does a podcast with and finds out all these little bits and pieces. But I'm always really lazy and go, do you have like a site everything's connected on, and I'll put that up, or I'll dig around.
Yeah, I can do that. I've got a it's not the full body of work. I was never really good at keeping any of the work, so I might have to get some off you at some stage as well. But I've kind of got some latest hits and a few of the greatest, and it's got a sexy photo of me staring off wistfully into the distance. So I'll give that to you, and any of your listeners can have a look if they can be bothered.
Yeah, make sure you send me the sexy photo, because I'd say probably about a quarter of the time I just find a picture online and then get an email 3 days later going, I really hate that photo. Could you put this one up instead? So tell me the one you want, and I'll put that. Yeah.
No, the one on my site is the one to use. You can just take a screenshot and share it with all the sundry.
Brilliant. Okay, well, I'll keep you from the park no longer, and you can go and enjoy the lovely weather. For me, it's the end of the day, but I've really enjoyed having another chat with you, Cam. And we had dinner a few weeks ago, so it was good to catch up with you then. But yeah, if you're ever in LA again, or I'm in Sydney, we'll catch up face to face one more time. So that'd be really cool.
I will be, and I will do. And yeah, I do enjoy when we catch up. And my wife just sent me a note saying that they've gone to the pub, and that sounds interesting to me.
Brilliant. Give my love to Zorica. Okay.
I will do. Okay. All right, then.
Cheers, Cam.
Cheers, mate.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
If this is a podcast, then what's Christmas?